This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be discussing some recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions and also some cases currently before the court. It's my great pleasure to have some very, very knowledgeable people on these cases. Cynthia Larson, a certified specialist in appellate law. She's chair of the Commission on Appellate Law of the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. She's a partner in the international law firm of Orrick, Harrington and Sutcliffe, the Sacramento office. Jeffrey Hayden, certified specialist in criminal law. He's president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. And Myron Moskowitz, professor of constitutional law emeritus and appellate law litigator. This segment of Your Legal Rights is funded by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which has 11 specializations, 11 fields of law of specialty. There's so many, I won't tell you about them right now, however. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, and the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco. There has been an enormous amount of discussion on radio, on television, regarding the same-sex couples cases. A couple of days ago, the state of Alabama petitioned or went to the U.S. Supreme Court to ask for a stay with respect to an order by a U.S. district judge that the ban on gay marriage be upheld. The Supreme Court would not do that. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with talking about same-sex couples cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. There's four of them right now. We will then go to some traffic stop cases, which I think all of us can, or many of us can relate to when we're stopped by a police officer on the road. So listen carefully on this one, everybody. We will then go to a case involving a candidate for a judgeship in Florida who actually sent out some solicitations for contributions, and the issue of freedom of speech came up in that case. So let's start with Myron Moskowitz. Myron, start, if you would, with this Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals related to the same-sex couples case.
Okay. Thanks, Chuck. So everybody's been reading in the paper the last few months about various courts around the country striking down these bans on same-sex marriage. It happened in California. It's happened most places. And somewhat surprisingly, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeal in the Midwest came out the other way and upheld the bans in four states, Michigan, Kentucky, Ohio, and Tennessee. All those states had enacted laws very similar to Proposition 8 that says marriage is between a man and a woman, essentially outlawing gay marriage. So all of a sudden, now we have a conflict, and that's what the Supreme Court looks for in deciding whether to accept a case for review. And this comes on the heels of a couple of cases that were decided last year. One was the case involving DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, where Congress had said that people involved in same-sex marriage could not get any kind of federal benefit, and the court struck that down in an opinion that did two things. It was based on two aspects. One is the court had some strong language that suggested that they didn't like discrimination of any form against same-sex couples. And the other part was they didn't like the federal government telling the states what to do regarding marriage. That's always been a matter for states. So in that case, they didn't directly confront the question of whether states could ban same-sex marriage. But there was language suggesting that they were oriented in that direction. The other case did involve a direct attack on California's same-sex marriage ban, Proposition 8. The lower court had struck it down, but the Supreme Court held that the proponents of Prop 8 didn't have standing to bring an appeal, mm-hmm. so they dismissed it without ever getting the merits to it.
And that's because the Attorney General and the governor didn't take a
that's
role.
Right. The that's Attorney right. General and the governor were sued and both declined to defend. So it was left to these proponents to defend, and the court said that wasn't good enough to give them standing to litigate the issue. So now, for the first time, the court is directly confronted with this issue. There don't appear to be any standing or other procedural problems, and I think they'll get to the merits of the case.
Can I turn to Cynthia for a minute? Cynthia, what comments do you have? Unfortunately, there are not so many cases that I want you all to talk about that there's only so much time. But Cynthia, what comments do you have about the current case before the Supreme Court on same-sex couples and marriage?
Well, I think it's quite clear that the Supreme Court will delve directly into the merits. In granting review, the Supreme Court stated that it wishes to hear argument on two issues, and really only two issues. First, does the 14th Amendment require a state to license a marriage between two people of the same sex?
That's due process of the 14th?
Yes, and then, due process. And then second, does the 14th Amendment, contains both due process and equal protection clauses to, protect people such as those who are going before the Supreme Court in this same-sex marriage case. So the second issue that the court has said that it will review is whether the 14th Amendment requires a state to recognize a marriage between two people of the same sex when their marriage was licensed and performed in another state.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two questions. The court's made it very clear what it wants to consider, and I think there's little doubt that the court's just going to zero right in on those issues and make a decision now on this.
Does anyone want to predict what's going to happen?
Yeah, the recent action the Supreme Court took in the Alabama situation it strongly suggested that they'll strike down these four states' laws banning same-sex marriage. That what Alabama asked the Supreme Court do was simply to stay the federal district court's decision striking Alabama's law banning same-sex marriage. It was quite a logical argument. I mean, the issue is pending in the Supreme Court. We don't know what they're going to do. Let's just stay enforcement until the Supreme Court decides. One would think that if the Supreme Court had any doubt as to what they were going to do, they would grant the stay.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't. Majority of them didn't over this very strong protest of Justices Scalia and Thomas, said, you guys are effectively prejudging this thing. And they're right. They were prejudging it. And I think it's a strong indication they will strike them down. Incidentally, I read the Sixth Circuit decision by Judge Sutton, who led the court in upholding those laws from the Midwest. And he makes about the strongest case you can for upholding those laws.
The ban on same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
What I want to do, Myron, because we could spend the whole time on this, but I want to move ahead.
Okay.
Cynthia, half a minute. Any further comments on the same-sex case before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes, I agree with what was just said in terms of a prediction, and I think a very strong bellwether there is the fact that when Clarence Thomas dissented from the ruling of the Supreme Court denying the stay, he himself was concerned that the court was telegraphing too clearly what it was about to do, and so we may well see the decision come out in favor of marriage equality.
Now, I want to turn to a couple of cases. One is Navarrete versus California, which is one where a woman makes a call, a 911 call, reporting that she has been run off the road by a truck. And a few minutes later, a law enforcement officer sees this truck, which she has described to the 911 operator. He stops this vehicle, and this is an important case. And one of the interesting things about this, and I hope we have time to talk about it a little bit, is Justice Scalia writes a dissent, which is joined by Justice Ginsburg, Sotomayor, and Kagan. Scalia being the conservative, the other three women are quite liberal. But, Myron, if you would start that one, and then we'll go to Jeff on the Rodriguez case.
Okay, so Chuck described the basic facts. These police officers up in Humboldt County get a phone call from a dispatcher saying some woman called in on 9/11 saying somebody just tried to run her off the road. She gave the license number of the car, and this just happened a few minutes ago, and he's going southbound on Route 1. She didn't give her name, all right? And that's the main problem here. The police then stop the car, smell marijuana, and end up arresting this guy for carrying marijuana.
And they find 30 pounds of marijuana in a vehicle.
And he moves to suppress it, keep it out of his trial, saying it's the product of the initial stop, which was in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Because the cases say to stop somebody, not arrest, but just stop them for investigation, the police need to have reasonable suspicion. Mm-hmm. And his lawyer, Navarrete's lawyer, argued that the suspicion was not reasonable because this woman didn't give her name. And if she didn't give her name, she could be a vengeful ex-wife or lover or some enemy and just making the whole thing up, because she would face no repercussions if she lied. And that's the basic issue in the case, all right? The majority opinion written by Justice Thomas goes through the facts and basically says, look, she was not free of repercussions because they can trace those calls and find out who she is.
Trace to the phone number that
That's
was
right.
used. Yeah.
The dissent by Justice Scalia, who, by the way, may be conservative, but he's also a libertarian, and he's often in the front on Fourth Amendment issues. He's very vociferous about it, and he often is, as you said, joined by the liberals on that. He says the fact that they could trace her call doesn't make any difference if she didn't know it, and there was no evidence she knew it. She thought she was free of any. So the two sides, Thomas and Scalia, go through these details. Thomas says she gave the license number. That shows she really knew what she was talking about. Scalia comes back. Well, if she saw the license number, this guy must have been around for a while.
Yeah.
He couldn't have been that drunk if he stuck around and she had time to write the thing down. So they go back and forth in this thing. It's a very, very close case, and the majority ends up saying that it's okay to stop people in this situation. They both talk about some cases involving guns and some serious type of thing. Thomas says this is serious. Mm-hmm. Someone's drunk, then they could kill somebody. Yeah. Scalia comes back and says just because she said he ran her off the road doesn't necessarily mean he's drunk. You know, he might have been trying to avoid a pothole or a rabbit or something like that. So it's a fascinating dialogue between two very intelligent justices leading the way on both sides of this thing. Normally, they're together. Scalia and Thomas, you almost say in one breath, usually vote together.
Yeah.
But not this time. They're at opposite sides, and it's a fascinating dialogue between two very bright justices.
And the point was that the Fourth Amendment was not violated.
That's
what the
right.
court said.
So the marijuana is admissible, and guy's going to serve some time.
Yeah. Jeff, if you would, how about the Rodriguez case? I want to say, if you don't mind my saying this for a minute, one of the cute things in this the oral argument was Justice Breyer, this is a situation where I think many of us can relate to being stopped by police officers while driving a vehicle for whatever. Maybe our rear tail light is out or whatever. But one of the things that I thought was apparently the justices had some fun with this, including Justice Sotomayor saying as she addressed the Chief Justice, quote, "I've been stopped." And then Justice Breyer, Stephen Breyer, said, quote, "Our experience on stops comes from, unfortunately, being the stoppee," end quote. But, Jeff, go ahead with this one, if you would, and because this is a dog sniff case.
Yes, Rodriguez is a dog sniff case. I'm not a dog person myself. But
you're a cat person, right?
I am.
Okay.
Rodriguez was argued 3 weeks ago today, so we're still awaiting the decision in the case. But it's rather interesting in that it also involved a traffic stop. A Nebraska canine officer had pulled over a vehicle because they saw it veer to the side of the road. No question about the legality of the traffic stop. That's really not what's here, but more the scope of that stop. In Rodriguez, the officer pulled over the car, correctly so. addressed the violation, wrote a written warning, but then asked the driver if it was okay if he could walk the canine around the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
The driver declined. Nevertheless, the officer ordered him out of the car mm-hmm. in order to let the dog do a complete search. So 7-8 minutes go by after the ticket's written before the dog alerts on a spot. They go, they conduct a search, and they find a large bag of methamphetamine. And there's two real issues that are brought up here. Justice Kagan was rather concerned about where this is all going. If the stop's upheld, does this mean that the officers might have, as she put it, 40 minutes of free time to investigate whatever other crime they might choose to look into?
And even though the initial situation was one of apparently this vehicle veering over the line over onto the shoulder.
Exactly. So yeah. There's no question about the legality of the stop. That's really not the issue that brought it up
right.
to the Supreme Court.
Right.
In this case, the issue was what's within the scope of that stop? What is a routine traffic stop? And whereas Justice Kagan was concerned about the length of time and whether that might lead to longer and longer times, and it's really focusing on that, the other issue this would lead to is whether the dog sniff was really extraneous to the reason for the stop. And in other cases where the intrusion is much more brief, much more limited, such as asking the drivers, what are you doing tonight? Where are you going? In this case, there's a dog sniff after everything's completed. It has nothing to do with the case. It's really kind of a fishing expedition. And Justice Alito was questioning, well, if it's okay to do these other things without reasonable suspicion, why is it not okay for the dog sniff?
The dog alerted to something in the vehicle.
Yes, but not for 7 or 8 minutes.
Yes, right. And the dog is outside of the vehicle.
The dog was outside, and in earlier decisions, the Supreme Court has looked at dog sniff and said, look, when that's done at the same time as a traffic stop, it's not really a problem. You have no expectation.
That is not considered a search.
You have no expectation of privacy in what emanates from your car and can be picked up on the outside. It's really rather limiting what they can do at the same time they're otherwise conducting a traffic stop. In this case, what separates it out is that the stop was completed, the ticket was written, and they dragged it on another 7 or 8 minutes. But it was a canine officer. They were looking for something. It's unrelated to the stop. There's no indication there was any reasonable suspicion that anything was going on inside,
mm-hmm.
and yet they wanted to look further.
Mm-hmm. So, and the court held, well, this is before the court right now.
Yeah, the courts below upheld it. The district court and then the Court of Appeal, I believe it was the Eighth Circuit, had held, well, it's a minimal delay, minimal intrusion, we'll allow it. And the Supreme Court is looking to see whether it was a prolonged detention, unlawfully prolonged detention, or similarly whether that was within the scope. And we should find out in another 2-3 months.
Myron, what comments on this one?
Yeah, I've been kind of following this issue for some years. It's a very common practice for police, particularly on major interstate highways. They stop somebody legitimately for some traffic violation,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and then they're trained to go further.
Mm-hmm.
This guy might be carrying drugs.
Yeah.
Let's look around, okay?
Yeah.
And the first thing they'll do when they have some suspicion is ask for consent. All right, and if they get it, that's it.
That's
they
fine.
Can search. That's
sure.
fine. Rodriguez refused. He wouldn't consent to a further investigation after the cop wrote the warning,
mm-hmm.
all right, and
mm-hmm.
he was going to go. He wouldn't consent. What happens next? Here's the way the Supreme Court's going to write the opinion. They're going to talk about two possible seizures. Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable seizures. First seizure's the stop for the veering off the road. They're
mm-hmm.
going to say that's okay. That's easy. The second thing the cop did, he hands him the warning, and then he brings in the dog and he orders the guy out of the car.
And the reason
right?
the few minutes pass is because he has called for backup.
Right, right. I'm sorry.
For another officer.
Yeah.
And the other officer
okay.
has the dog.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, is that a seizure? The government says it's not.
Yeah.
It's de minimis. It's only 8 minutes.
Right.
All right. And because if it's not a seizure, the cops can do it.
Mm-hmm.
If it is a seizure, it has to be justified by new reasonable suspicion. Not the veering off the road, but something about smelling it or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And they
and
probably
these dogs
can't do
are
that.
Trained. These dogs are trained to do this.
But they hadn't done it yet.
Yeah.
See, that happened after
right.
he detained the
okay.
guy.
Okay.
So the dog smelling the drugs doesn't justify it.
Okay.
Because that happened later.
Right.
All right? So I predict the court's going to find that second 8-minute detention is a seizure under the Fourth Amendment, and they're going to say it's not justified.
Not justified.
I mean, 8 minutes is a long time for the cops to hold. Can they just walk up to you in the street and hold you for 8 minutes with no reason at all? I mean, that's really what it would amount to under the government's argument. This is de minimis.
Jeff, any further comments on this one?
Well,
do you agree with Myron?
I agree with what he says. I'm hoping that's the outcome in this case. One of the hallmarks we look to in search and seizure law, whether it's taking confessions without Miranda, whether it's the right to detain somebody in general, is whether a reasonable person under those circumstances would feel free to leave.
Yeah.
And here, long after the traffic stop is completed for purposes of writing a ticket and they're done, with no suspicion whatsoever, the officer detained the person, had him wait outside the car so that he could conduct a search without even a hunch.
So you agree with Myron then?
Completely.
Do you? Okay. Let's turn to this, and we may come back to any one of these cases. For those of you, by the way, who are listening to us live, I will give you our phone number in a few minutes. Whether you are listening to us live in the Bay Area or listening to us live on the Internet at www.kalw.org, you will be able to call in, ask a question, make a comment, have a discussion with my guests. Cynthia, let me come to you on this one. This is the one where a lawyer, and this is now in Florida, a lawyer by the name, last name of Williams-Yulee, Y-U-L-E-E, the case name is Williams-Yulee versus Florida Bar. She was a candidate for a judge down there, and she sent out a mass mailing soliciting people to make contributions to her campaign. The Florida Bar didn't like that. They cited her for this. And so what came out of this is that the lawyer felt that she was being deprived of her freedom of speech, First Amendment rights, and so now we have this case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Tell us about it, would you, Cynthia, please?
Certainly. Just a side note, it's interesting. This case is before the United States Supreme Court, but Williams-Yulee apparently never raised a dime through her solicitation letter.
But poorly written letter.
But nonetheless, the case does involve an extremely important issue for the public and for us in the legal profession who can be subject to being asked to make contributions by a judge before whom we have a case, for example.
Why should we care about that?
Why should we care? Well, the Supreme Court and the justices indicated why. Well, first of all, one good reason to care is that the case will have nationwide consequences. However it comes at the Supreme Court, 39 of our states elect at least some judges, and 30 of those states ban judicial candidates from making personal calls and solicitations seeking campaign contributions. So however the the justices decide this, it will have a major impact on judicial fundraising. But the reason that the justices, I think, granted review, and the reason that they care, is that they're concerned about free speech. Free speech has been a very important issue for the Roberts Court. But what they have to do is balance that against what they view as the dignity of judges and the dignity of the judicial process. The oral argument was held in this case just a few weeks ago, in mid-January, and the tension between free speech and the rights of judges to seek contributions and the propriety of the conduct of our judges was very starkly portrayed. Some of the justices suggested that the reason for these regulations and laws is that our justices and our judges need to be above the fray and that it's undignified for them to go around asking people for money.
And also it might, if you do get money from someone, it might cause a judge to be more favorable to that person who may well be a party or may well be representing a party because of the contribution.
That's right. And there's also concern about the coercive element, mm-hmm. that if a judge, particularly when a judge him or herself makes the request, that it's very, very difficult for an attorney or a member of the public who may at some point have a case before that judge to turn that judge down. In mm-hmm. fact, Judge Sotomayor commented about that, Justice Sotomayor. She said, it's, quote, very, very, very rare for a lawyer to turn her down when she makes any kind of a request.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
Yes, but the justice has pointed out that the Florida scheme may not really address the problem that they're trying to address here, because in Florida, even though a judge cannot directly request a campaign contribution, he or she is permitted under the applicable rules in Florida to write a follow-up letter if she does get one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that this direct line of communication, the justices pointed out, might in and of itself have the same coercive effect or the same effect just by virtue of an after-the-fact direct contact, reinforcing the idea that the judge expects the contribution.
Cynthia, let me interrupt at this point because I want to get one more very brief case in from Jeff, and it's the Riley case. What are you concerned about in the Riley case?
The Riley case involved searching your smartphone that was on your person when you were arrested. 4 years ago, the California Supreme Court said that was just fine in Riley versus California. Anytime you were arrested, if you had it on your person, they could search it at will. They could search it at the time. They could search it later.
Mm-hmm.
All the most sensitive data you might have in their emails, yours, anybody that you might have listed in your phone, it all became fair game. It really let the police officers have major leeway to really look into your existence in this electronic age. That case came up, was decided late last year by the United States Supreme Court in the case of Riley v. California, and they felt quite differently. The Supreme Court held that without a warrant, you can't get into there. The police can secure the phone, put it in an area free from electronic signal so that they could protect the data long enough to get a warrant, but they can't just go in and search.
We have come to the end of the statewide version. I want to let you know it's now just about 7:28 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. I'm sorry we have to go so quickly, everyone, but I want to give you now an opportunity. If you have some questions about any of these cases or any other decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court or other cases that you are aware of that are before the U.S. Supreme Court for decision, hopefully this year, please feel comfortable in calling 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. Whether you are in the Bay Area or whether you are anywhere else in the country, we're on the air by the internet all over the country. I think most people, however, are listening who are in California. So whether you're listening on the internet at www.klw.org or if you're listening in the Bay Area, the number to call 1-415-841-4134. Let me tell you who we have here. By the way, if you tune in a little bit late, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing a discussion of recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions as well as current cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. My guests are Cynthia Larson, certified specialist in appellate law. She's chair of the Commission on Appellate Law, which is a part of the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. She's a partner in the international law firm of Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe in the Sacramento office. Jeffrey Hayden is here. Jeff is a certified specialist in criminal law. He's president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. And Myron Moskowitz, professor of constitutional law emeritus and also an appellate law litigator. So I want to encourage you not to be bashful, everyone, and call in and let us know maybe your thoughts about things, about the Supreme Court, about some of the decisions that have been made. Please don't be bashful. The number again, 1-415-841-4134. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer, you can call 415-989-1616. 415-989-1616. If you are in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own at 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county has a bar association and lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours. Tell them what your problem is. They'll do their best to try to find you someone who's experienced and have a half an hour consultation with that attorney. And so call, and hopefully that will be of help to you. With rare exception, the cost for a half an hour consultation through lawyer referral will range from $25 to $35. And that doesn't go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service, because this is a very fine consumer service. Here's a question that was brought into the studio to me. What happens to, quote, probable cause, end quotes, when scanners are routinely applied to furnish police cruising the field with detailed background information on each vehicle, question mark? When an observer has instant access to a vehicle's track record, what is, quote, probable cause? Would you like to talk about that, Myron, please?
Yeah, there's a lot of fascinating questions are coming up with new technology. So police car has a scanner on it. It looks at the license plate, immediately goes in to the dispatcher and, you know, find out if the guy's got a warrant out, something like that. Fourth Amendment prohibits unreasonable searches. Probable cause is part of what goes into unreasonable, but you don't get to that question unless it's a search. Is it a search to use a scanner to look at the license plate and then funnel that into the dispatcher? Most courts would say no, it's not a search at all, mm-hmm. because the cop can drive his patrol car behind your car and look at the license right. plate and read it to the dispatcher, and that's not a search. Anybody out in public can see your license plate. That's not a search. That's not an intrusion on your expectation of privacy, because everyone can see it. That's the whole point of having a license plate, so people can see it. All right. What makes it a little more difficult is you got this electronic device that allows the cop to scan hundreds or thousands of these things.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Does that make a difference? Well, there was a case that came down a couple of years ago from the Supreme Court involving attachment of a GPS to a car. They thought this guy was a drug dealer. They attached a
GPS. They put it underneath the car.
They put it on the undercarriage.
Yeah.
All right. And it told the location of the car, wherever it went.
At all times.
And they used that as evidence at his trial on, mm-hmm. on dealing drugs, all right? Now, the prosecution said, hey, this guy was driving on public roads. We could have followed him. We didn't have to use the GPS. Where you go on a public road mm-hmm. is not private, mm-hmm. so it's not an intrusion on privacy. The majority kind of got around that whole dispute by saying the attachment of the device to the undercarriage was a search.
It was a trespass, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a trespass, therefore a search. There was no probable cause, so the whole thing falls.
Yeah.
But along the way, the court had some very critical remarks about these fancy new devices. So the question is a good one. Does this new invention that didn't exist when the 4th Amendment was adopted in 1789, these scanners, does that change the game, because the cops can do so much more with electronics than they can do with the naked eye? Is that a greater intrusion on privacy?
Yeah.
I still think the court will not strike that down or find that's a search, but I could be wrong.
Any other comments on this?
No. Once again, I agree with Professor Moskowitz. In general, the courts have held that what you hold out to the public really defeats any expectation of privacy you might have had. Mm-hmm. So just as not hiding your face when you're walking down the street, you really can't expect that no one's able to identify you. Mm-hmm. Your license plate is probably no different.
Okay. Cynthia, any comments on this?
No.
All right.
Comment. I agree.
All right. Let me get Steve on the air. Steve, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
What a great program. first of all, I want to say that this is very timely with all the stuff that's going on in Supreme Court. I was in D.C. back a long time ago. I worked for a big law firm here in town, and I had an opportunity, and the public does, to go to watch a case at Supreme Court, and I would definitely recommend that to anyone. Very interesting and really gives you a great flavor of what's going on. It doesn't even matter that much what the case is. Would your panelists please talk about, in general, how many cases are brought up in the very small number, it might be 1%, that are granted cert by the Supreme Court? And then also the way that these are kind of hand-picked, that they watch which ones will bubble up, because there's two basic reasons that they go to the Supreme Court. If there's a difference in the split in the circuits, or if they want to put down a new rule. So great program, and thank you very much.
Steve, thank you very much. Cindy, do you have some comments on that?
Yes. Well, you know, the general rule is that your chances of getting your case into the Supreme Court are probably, you know, in the 5% or less range. If you can show a conflict in the circuits, that's typically how you're able to get the interest of the Supreme Court. For example, you know, in the same-sex marriage cases, the court, once the conflict was created between the Sixth Circuit and other circuits, rather quickly and expeditiously granted cert, and now that case is going to be reviewed.
Mm-hmm.
So I would echo the conclusion of the listener that it is very difficult, but if you can show a conflict between the circuits or a question that is of just such extreme significance in terms of the protection of constitutional rights, that's how you may be able to.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm just writing a new edition of my book on appeals, and I have a chapter on getting to the top court, whether it's U.S. Supreme Court or California Supreme Court. And I write there that it's kind of shocking that an attorney would spend his client's money filing a petition with, Cynthia says it's about 5%. It's usually less than that. It's usually around 1%.
Really?
Would you file a lawsuit against somebody with a 1% chance of success and spend their money on it? Of course not. But they do it. And what's the reason why everybody is wasting all this money? And I think it's usually that they get an adverse decision from the lower court, and they're angry about it, and they think it's wrong. And by God, you've heard people say this, I'm going to the Supreme Court because this was wrong. That's not what the Supreme Court is there for.
Yeah.
They don't do that. They're not a court of error correction. As Cynthia said, they deal with two things. Conflicts among the lower courts, which doesn't happen very often. It's got to be a real conflict that's out there in the opinion. And secondly, something of such overwhelming importance, you know, like the Pentagon Papers case, where somebody is disclosing a national secret. Otherwise, they say, all right, you got screwed by the lower court. Too bad. Live with it. You know, we're not here to correct that.
Jeff.
We've heard it said time and time again, there ought to be a law. That's really when the Supreme Court wants to get involved. And I don't disagree with what the other speakers have just said in terms of the numbers or how few cases get there. I really want to underscore it. Whether it's 3% or 1%, these are of the petitions that are meant, that are going to the Supreme Court, will you look at this case? 1%, 2%, 3%, whatever it is. But of all the cases that are filed, very few actually get as far as a trial where you get that appeal to the appellate court.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes that's in the state. Very few go further than that. So we're talking of those that have exhausted all the remedies in the state courts or maybe worked their way up through the federal system and then gone on to appeal, of those, 1-3%. So we're down to tiny fractions of a percent of the cases filed that really get to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yeah.
It's a 1-in-1,000,000 shot that
in
a case filed.
The California Supreme Court, they take about 75 a year out of 6,000 petitions.
Oh, wow.
And that's the California Supreme Court.
Wow.
Supreme Court is the U.S. Supreme
much
Court.
More than that, All right. I want to encourage you all, don't be bashful. 1-415-841-4134. 1-415-841-4134. 4134. If you have some comment, you have some question about some case that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided or you think is currently before the Supreme Court, please, let's hear from you. And let me tell you again, if any of you have tuned us in a little bit late, please never do that again. Always join us at 7 p.m. Pacific time. But my guests are, let me reverse the order, Myron Moskovitz, professor of constitutional law emeritus and appellate law litigator. Jeff Hayden, certified specialist in criminal law and the president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. And Cynthia Larson, certified specialist in appellate law, chair of the Commission on Appellate Law. So let's see who we might have in another minute or so. I want to let all of you know, by the way, that we are going to do Call a Lawyer next week, and which is unusual for us, the third Wednesday of the month, February 18th. We're doing that because the last week, the last Wednesday of the month, we're going to do preparing your tax return for the year 2014. So the people who I'm going to have here on the 25th, my guest is a certified specialist in taxation law, and we'll have CPAs here. And therefore, we wanted to do it early enough to help you with your tax returns. So that's why we're doing Call a Lawyer next week. That's 1-800-525-9917. And we'll be talking about the Educating Seniors Project of the Trust and Estate section of the State Bar. So those of you who may be admit that you're a senior, or if you're the offspring of a senior, you may want to tune in to the program next week. We have a lot of people who are kind of bashful to call in, and I'm sorry to hear that. Cynthia, what other point would you like to bring across for the listeners with respect to appellate law?
Well, we had an interesting comment just a few minutes ago about the likelihood of being able to have your case heard before the highest court in the land. It caused me to reflect a little bit on some of the work that I've done before the Supreme Court. And I think it is the case that what you find is that many of the cases on which the United States Supreme Court grants certiorari, meaning grants review, tend to be kind of recurrent in nature. I mean, for example, one area in which the Supreme Court ends up taking quite a few cases is in the area of aviation disasters. Let's just pick one out, even though that maybe is sort of counterintuitive. But in reality, those cases present complicated conflicts of law issues, which law should be applied to an air crash that involves, passengers in different parts of the globe, that involves a plane that maybe originated in Seattle, but, parts that came from England, and just extremely complicated conflicts of law issues that the court likes to entertain. The court also likes personal jurisdiction issues, where the court's called upon to decide whether or not a state court has jurisdiction over a person, a person living in another country or a person living in another state, such that it's appropriate to decide that person's rights. And if you bring that kind of a case, you may have a little higher a case involving those issues. If that's come up in your case in the trial court, you may have a little bit better luck in getting the court to review your case. But if you have a case, for example, where you've simply don't like the way that the trial court made rulings on evidence, that's tougher. Issues that like that are very often tough to get the court's attention.
Myron, go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to this case we were talking about earlier from Florida involving the judge who sent out a campaign letter. And it raises some fascinating issues that I've been thinking about for a while. Judges, like everybody else, have certain rights that can't be taken away. They can vote in elections. They can speak out on neighborhood issues. But does that mean they can do everything that other people can do? Mm-hmm. At the oral argument in this case, Justice Scalia said, well, look, if I write an opinion that people criticize, Can I then write an op-ed column answering the critics? And he says, absolutely not. You know, my opinions speak for themselves, and state bars all have rules that prohibit judges from doing that, and they have to for the dignity of the office and to make the system work. So judges, in their job as a judge, they can't do everything. Everybody else can't. People have certain jobs where they have limitations in what they can do. If you're the president's or the governor's press secretary, and the governor takes a position on some issue, you can't go in front of the press and saying, I disagree with the governor. You're going to lose your job, all right? So there are limitations by your job. Right. Now, what makes this so hard, there's another angle here, that I wish Justice O'Connor was still on the court to decide this case.
Yes.
Because she did not like the whole idea of people electing judges.
Yeah.
You know, in the federal system,
sure,
federal judges are appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, mm-hmm, and most people think you get a very high level of judge in that situation. In a lot of states do something similar. But some, like California, we elect our judges, mm-hmm, particularly our trial court judges. And political campaigns are the most protected type of speech.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when you put those together? You get a campaign for an office that probably shouldn't be an elective office,
mm-hmm,
but it is political. People, mm-hmm, are voting for it. Can the candidates say anything and do anything? I think this is going to be a case where, for the first time, I think, in the Roberts Court, they're going to uphold a state restriction on speech. They've been striking them down right and left, mm-hmm, starting with Citizens, mm-hmm, United and, mm-hmm, and a whole bunch of them. But this is a time I think they're going to uphold it.
What do you think? What do you think on that, Cynthia?
Well, I would agree, except for the fact that this particular ban has so many loopholes that the justices may decide that it really doesn't do what it needs to serve its goal of preventing corruption, you know, preventing problems and corruption and coercion from the bench.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the ban might just fail because the ban is just, you know, not very well thought out.
Yeah.
So if it does fail, I think that would be the reason.
Let me throw something out to you and to everyone who's listening. Catherine called in, and this has been written down, brought to me in the studio. Please explain how a chief justice is picked. How much does seniority have to do with taking the chief justice's seat on the bench? Now, certainly, the current chief justice really had no seniority on the bench.
The best example is Earl Warren. He'd never been a judge.
Yeah.
And he was appointed Chief Justice of the United States,
yeah,
Supreme Court.
Yeah. So how is someone selected? Is it you're helping the president to become elected? Is that how we do it? Or?
At the U.S. Supreme Court level, that doesn't happen that often. It's up to the president. He can do anything he wants. There's a great story about Eisenhower. His attorney general spoke to him and said there was an opening on the Supreme Court. And the attorney general said to Eisenhower, you know, who do you want? He said, well, I'd like someone from the Northeast. And then he had another conversation. He said, you know, I think we need a Catholic. And then another conversation, he said, we need a state court judge. And the attorney general came away and said, now, were these alternatives or does he want all three? And he looked around and there was only one person he found who was qualified who met all three.
Who was that?
Brennan.
Justice Brennan.
The Supreme Court
William
of
Brennan.
New Jersey.
Yeah.
And he was a Catholic. So there you are.
There you go. Any other comments with respect to this question that Catherine has posed? How do we explain it? How to explain how a chief justice is picked, or is that it? Jeff?
No, that's exactly right, that the president picks it. Only five of the 17 chief justices that have served on the court as associate actually served on the court as associate justices before becoming chief.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Every president tends to have their own perspective on who makes a good justice, whether it's a justice or chief justice. President Clinton tended to see it as a hurdle. He wanted the absolute most qualified because he didn't want to face the opposition of a Republican Congress much of the time he was in office. On the other hand, President Obama seems to be of a very different mindset. He likes taking people that are not only not on the Supreme Court, but oftentimes never been on the court, and some haven't even practiced law. They come right out of teaching it in law school.
There's one thing more they want these days. They want them young.
Uh-huh.
You know, Roberts was young.
Yeah.
Each one, the old days, they picked people like Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was already, I think, in his 80s when he got appointed. But they want them young so they can be there another 40 years after the president's gone.
Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to put the stamp they want their legacy to last forever. So they're going to pick young people that think like they do. And the trouble is, every president has found that some of the people they appoint in the end don't think like they do or like they thought they would.
All right. Okay. Well, any further comments on that? Apparently not. Okay. All right. I again want to give you our phone number, 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. I guess you either, all of you are either mesmerized by this discussion or
asleep.
Well, this is so what we want to do, something positive, and if it's helping them to sleep, that's fine. So if you have some comment or concern or a question, certainly join us if you would. Jeff, any other thoughts you want to throw into the hopper here in the remaining minutes of the program?
It seems that on the criminal front, a lot of the decisions coming up before the Supreme Court are revisiting the rules under the Fourth Amendment that relate to search and seizure.
Yeah.
For example, we didn't talk about Fernandez versus California. Fernandez looked at the age-old question of two people can occupy a premises together. Can one of them consent to search? And the general rule is, if they're both there and one consents, the other one's free to object. And you really can't give away somebody else's legitimate expectation of privacy. Fernandez involved a case where there were two occupants, one of which objected, said, no, you can't. The other one said, yes, I can. And the police in the Fernandez case had a legal basis to arrest the one that was saying no, not based on what they found in the search, but preceding the search. And then they went ahead and conducted the search because he wasn't there and wasn't standing up.
Well, they took him out. They took him out of the apartment. They arrested him, took him out of the apartment.
And he was no longer present to object. And the Supreme Court said exactly that. You have to be present to object. So even in the case where he was arrested and pulled out after objecting, he was no longer there to object. So the other one could say, sure, come on in.
And that is a decision that is final from the U.S. Supreme Court, right?
Within the past year, yes.
The past year. Harry, welcome to the program.
Hi, yes. I was wondering, you know, it seems to me I'm not a lawyer and I used to think all lawyers were like Clarence Darrow, but it's really a very dull, arcane type of field. Now, I was wondering the type of, you know, specious type of thinking you have to do contributes to sort of myopic thinking that you often see in court decisions, and also the fact that that there's so much corporate influence is also going to affect who you get in these courts. For example, the Chief Justice of Alabama, I mean, that's just off the charts. Thank you.
Okay, so you're concerned about corporate involvement, et cetera, et cetera. Very good question, Harry. What comments do we have on this with respect to this?
I didn't quite understand the question.
I think you did. You get it, Jeff?
I got some of it. I think what Harry was saying is we must think out of a vacuum, because why would we spend time dissecting the crumb when there's other things to look at out there?
I thought he was also concerned that there's too much corporate influence.
I tend to think that what he was also commenting is that people that get chosen as judge, whether by election or whether by appointment, tend to be, because they have a following, not necessarily the best means of selecting, not necessarily the best and brightest to get there. And I can't entirely agree. It leaves some things to be desired, but in general, we know about these things. We hear about these things because we see the exception. We see where the rules are broken, where things don't work. And I can tell you from working in the system, overwhelmingly things work.
Well, let me answer it a little different way. Smart lawyers, most of them, go where the money is. The money is with the big firms. Mm-hmm. The money, and the big firms get the money by representing big corporations. So when these smart lawyers who in the big firms decide they want to become a judge, and they get it because they're smart and they have some influence, they're going to have some sympathy mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. for the business world.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a fact.
Yeah. Any comments from you, Cynthia, on that?
Yes. Well, I think it is also the case, though, that, for example, in California, our government lawyers, prosecutors, public defenders tend to be very well represented on our bench. And one of the important things that's looked at in the process of reviewing a person's qualifications when they are seeking to go on the bench is what kinds of activities have they been involved in? What have they done that's been mm-hmm. contributing to the good of the community or the good of the profession? So I think that the diversity of judges that sit in California is really quite broad and is not limited to people who have been in big firms and represented corporate clients. It's much, much more diverse on our bench than that.
All right. Let me take one more very brief comment, question, whatever. Jerry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Really quickly on marriage equality, and I'm sorry I missed the beginning of the program. I've heard two instances now, and one, of course, the most infamous, the Supreme Court Chief Justice of the state of Alabama saying, in essence, the state doesn't have to follow the Supreme Court's non-ruling and thus the appellate court's judgment. And I've also heard a member of the right who perennially runs for president say that these laws, even should the Supreme Court rule that marriage equality is now in all 50 states, that states do not have to follow these rulings because some law has to be passed by someone in order for this to actually go through and compel public employees, whether they probate judges, justices of the peace, whatever, to actually issue marriage licenses.
Let me get some comments on that, Jerry. I think.
Well,
yeah. Go ahead, Myron.
A couple of things. If the Supreme Court rules that states cannot deprive gay couples of the right to marry, that's going to bind everybody in the country. Every probate judge in Alabama takes an oath to support the U.S. Constitution, and that means the Supreme Court opinions. What the Chief Justice of Alabama Supreme Court did seems outrageous. It was reported as he instructed these judges not to follow the federal court order, which is like a reprise of the Civil War and the civil rights movement was happening there. He did have a technical ground for doing that, and that is that the order of the federal judge ran against the attorney general and not these probate judges. Now, the substance of it, of course, would apply to the probate judges, but technically he was right, and it was easily correctable by some type of new action by the federal judge, but which hasn't happened yet.
I want to thank the three of you for joining us on the program and all of you for listening. I found it very interesting to hear what you have to say. Thank you very much, Cynthia Larson, Chair of the Commission on Appellate Law, Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Hayden, thank you very much for being here. I hope to see you next week for our Call a Lawyer night.
It's always a pleasure. I look forward to seeing you next week.
Jeff is a certified specialist in criminal law. He's the president of the San Mateo County Bar Association. And Myron, it's always wonderful to have you on the program.
Nice to be here again, Chuck.
Myron Moskovitz, professor of constitutional law emeritus and appellate law litigator. Your legal rights production staff members are program engineer Debbie Kennedy. Nice to have you here, Debbie. Thank you very much. And Martin McLean, production assistant. The funding for this segment of Your Legal Rights has been made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar. Additional funding for the program is made possible by the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, the topic is the Educating Seniors Project. of the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar. My guest will be Jennifer Wilkerson, a certified specialist in estate planning, trust, and probate law. It is also our Call a Lawyer night, so I hope you will call in with your questions, et cetera, et cetera. 1-800-525-9917 for Call a Lawyer. Thank you very much for listening to Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Fitty.